The next case on our calendar is 07-254, Ohio Civil Rights Commission versus the Akron Metropolitan Housing Authority. Ms. Morris.
Chief Justice Moyer, Associate Justices, good morning. I'm here this morning with co-counsel James Casey on behalf of Akron Metropolitan Housing Authority and one of its property managers, June Davidson. This is a case of first impression in Ohio. And the issue before the court is whether or not this court should create a hostile living environment cause of action under the authority of the Fair Housing Act in Ohio, in particular, where there is no allegation that the landlord has engaged in any way or in any way discriminated against a tenant based on a protected classification. In other words, does this court want to create a cause of action based solely upon disputes amongst tenants? Appellants urge the court to decline to create such a cause of action for the reasons that the statutory language of the Fair Housing Act in Ohio does not support it. There is no controlling judicial support for it, and it's a cause of action that we simply do not need.
Counsel, is this cause of action recognized in any jurisdiction?
Your Honor, the answer to that question is not that I could find. I want to be really responsible about how I answer that, because in the cases, in the federal cases, there's a lot of discussion about hostile living environment and taking the evidentiary framework that has developed around Title VII employment law cases and sort of grafting that on to Title VIII in the federal domain. And in those cases, without exception, in the cases that recognize a hostile living environment claim, in those cases, the landlord or one of the landlord's agent was actively discriminating against a tenant.
So the landlord in those instances was the perpetrator of the hostile environment, created it, or an agent of the landlord, and not a co-tenant.
Correct.
That's what I'm, you know, was that trying to focus on. Absent an agent of the housing authority creating, and there's cases of that, we're all are aware of that, but a co-tenant or someone that has no authority over the victim, alleged victim, there's nothing
correct
on the books.
Not that I could find. And there the way that I would characterize the development of the law in this area is if we really look at the way the law has developed in the area of employment law, and we look at specifically what the definition of hostile environment in the workplace is, over time, let me back up and say that there's no question that the statute itself doesn't contain language that says hostile environment. What the court has done, and this is something that I know this court is well aware of, is in the employment domain, where employers are, where statutes exist to require employers to refrain from discriminating against employees. With respect to situations where an employee is discriminating against another employee and there's no management or supervisory authority between those two employees, the courts have extended the duty to regulate against such that type of discrimination to a supervisor or manager, and ultimately the liability to the employer or the owner of the company. This is a duty that already exists in the context of the employment domain.
And it requires an employer to do something affirmative to address the activity that is creating this hostile work environment, correct?
It does.
And in this particular instance, I would imagine that the appellees here would argue that the same burden is on the housing authority, that once it's brought to their attention that they have to do something to, especially when these the hostile living environment is based on allegations of race, that it's up to the housing authority to step in and do something here.
That is my understanding of the justification for extending the application of the fair housing law in the way that the Ninth District decided that, you know, the way they interpreted it. Mm-hmm. What I'm suggesting to the court is it's not workable, and this court shouldn't do it, and the reason is it's not analogous. When you have an employee, well, first of all, going back to the statutory language itself, in the domain, in under 411202A, it specifically sets forth that it is an unlawful discriminatory practice for any employer to discriminate. And as I was saying earlier, when you get into co-employees, they can't sue one another. They can only sue their employer. So under 411202A, it is a logical extension where you've got an environment where the employer is controlling the workplace and has specific controls on employees. There's very different dynamic in that relationship.
Doesn't the landlord control the environment of the rental property by telling someone you can't have a dog, or someone is particularly offensive to their neighbor, to at least warn them? There's a process, is there not, for the landlord here, the public landlord, to attempt to cause people to live in relative harmony, respecting one's desire to live in a peaceful place, or at least to enjoy the place in which they're living. Isn't that, I mean, I take it that the appellees really aren't, seems to me they're really not asking for it. If we find a legal basis for this, it seems to me they're not really asking for much. They're just saying there are processes for someone like a landlord or an employer to let's have the grievance presented. And there's a process for bringing the parties together, and perhaps it doesn't work out. But your position is a landlord has absolutely no responsibility to its tenants to create an environment in which people can live in somewhat in harmony. And I guess I go back to, as you know, the appellees mentioned the landlords all the time evict people because they don't live pursuant to the code or the regulations or the what's expected of them in living in a place in which people are living close together.
What I'm suggesting to the court is not that the landlord has no control over the tenants. What I'm suggesting to the court is that the relationship between a landlord and a tenant is different than the relationship between an employer and an employee. And I think the legislature recognized that when it created the statutory scheme that controls this. If you look at 411202H, which is the Fair Housing, the Ohio Fair Housing Act, that provision says that it shall be an unlawful discriminatory practice for any person to do any of the following. And if you look at how 4112 defines person, it defines person as one or more individuals. So in the fair housing context, excuse me, you have the opportunity for a tenant who is being discriminated against to sue the tenant who is engaged in the unlawful conduct. That is not the case in the arena of employment law, and there's a very logical reason for that. In a housing situation, I don't think the tenants want to be regulated or micromanaged by property managers in their relationships any more than the property managers want that duty imposed upon them. I don't think the authority under the statute is there to impose such a duty on a landlord. In fact, I think it results in actually creating a brand new tort. It doesn't do that.
And counsel, when you look at the statute in Section H, there the subparts are very specific about what is being prohibited by a landlord. Refusing to rent, for example, refusing to consider income and so on. The statute would not, at least as it currently stands, cover the situation that this case is about, would it?
It does not cover the situation that this case is about. Mm-hmm. And I want to emphasize that if a landlord is engaged in discrimination, or one of the landlord's agents or property managers, an agent, it is actionable under the statute exactly as it is, without adding anything, without borrowing from the employment law analysis. It's presently sufficient to counteract discrimination in housing.
But there's no respondeat superior for the actions of a tenant. I mean, if we wanted to use that terminology.
Correct. Okay. However, I just emphasize that there is an opportunity for a tenant to bring an action against another tenant. And one could even argue that by grafting on this Title VII analysis with respect to the evidentiary analysis, you're actually heightening the burden of proof to a severe and pervasive standard that isn't in the statute. So there is no requirement that when there is direct discrimination, that it has to meet a severe and pervasive standard. There's simply a matter of proof by preponderance of the evidence that there was direct discrimination. If there's not direct discrimination, then you go to disparate impact. Again, the federal cases that have looked at this issue, the development there, if you look at the cases, they really start by analyzing initially whether or not the Fair Housing Act Title VIII applies to occupancy, period. And then they say, yes, it does. Well, we're not even suggesting that it doesn't apply to occupancy. Yes, it applies to occupancy, but it should not apply to landlords in the sense of creating this duty in the true, pure sense of the term hostile work environment, like we use it in that context. It's not appropriate to just graft that on to the Ohio Civil Fair Housing Rights Act.
Ms. Morris, if I could turn you to the lease. It seemed that the Court of Appeals in part relied on the section that related to tenant obligations, which talked about a tenant not, you know, infringing on the rights of others. Was there any corresponding part of the lease agreement that would suggest that the landlord had the duty to enforce these tenant obligations to one another?
Was there any other part of the lease that did what?
That would have required the landlord to enforce these obligations between tenants. I mean, there's nothing that said if they're is a disturbance, the landlord will evict the party that is at fault or so on.
No, the provision that's quoted is the provision that addresses that.
Right.
And in the context of fair housing discrimination, that doesn't address discriminatory conduct. And looks like I got about 2 minutes and I'd like to reserve that for a rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Morris. Mr. Crumman.
Counsel, could I ask you the same question? Does the lease require the landlord to see that the tenants fulfill their obligations under the lease?
Absolutely, Your Honor. That's the provision of the lease. That's the responsibility of the landlord to the tenants and the other tenants in the housing accommodation.
Okay, and what portion of the lease are you referring to?
I apologize, Your Honor, I don't have the lease in front of me. The provision that the Ninth District looked at in its opinion.
Well, the quote that the Ninth District has is tenant obligations, saying the tenant agrees to conduct himself and so on. But it doesn't say anything about a landlord's obligation to the tenants. You're saying that you're relying on what was quoted in the Ninth District's opinion?
No, Your Honor, I apologize. I don't have the lease in front of me, but I do believe that the landlord has an obligation to the other tenants to ensure that the tenants are fulfilling their obligations under the lease.
Well, counsel, addressing that tenant obligation, I believe it's section section seven of the lease agreement that's referred to in the appellate The appellate opinion states that the MHA has control over who's allowed to be a tenant in their facilities and has the authority to evict anyone who does not comply with the terms of the lease they enter into with AMHA. In this case, the lease provided, and then that's the section that we're talking about here. I'm presuming that AMHA's responsibility of eviction is contained in that lease as well. In other words, they have those steps, sections to the lease, and it's spelled out in some place that if you violate this, you're subject to eviction.
Well, that's how I would read it, Your Honor. But interestingly, as much as the lease controls how AMHA may act in a particular case, I think the issue before the court is really whether the Ohio Fair Housing Act recognizes a cause of action for hostile housing environment claims. Despite what we've just heard, this case isn't about holding a landlord liable for the actions of a tenant. This case is about holding a landlord liable for their own negligence. And that negligence theory comes out of the employment context. If we follow the line of cases out of the U.S. Supreme Court, first with Meritor, where it initially recognized a respondent superior agency relationship in terms of the actions of an employee or a supervisor and the employer's liability, we found that the circuit courts had difficulty implementing that standard. And so subsequently in the Farragher case, the U.S. Supreme Court decided that under the final prong of the fifth prong of the test, which holds employers liable when they have notice or essentially knowledge for failing to take prompt and appropriate action, that came out of a negligence theory. And so in this case, we're asking the court to follow its own decision in the Hamble Court, where it recognized under its five-prong test.
And what would the prompt and appropriate action be here?
Well, a prompt and appropriate action obviously varies depending on the facts and circumstances of the harassment.
In this case?
In this case, Your Honor, I believe that there wasn't a prompt and appropriate. I believe that there...
What I'm asking you, what would be sufficient action? Would it be eviction?
Eviction may be one of the appropriate...
And did the lease permit eviction for failing to... Using inappropriate and racially charged language, or
Your Honor, I don't believe
causing a difficulty with neighbors.
Your Honor, that the Ohio Civil Rights Commission doesn't believe that a lease specifically needs to state that harassing or engaging in discriminatory conduct against another party needs to be in a lease for a leaseholder, specifically a landlord, to be able to evict. Essentially, any time a tenant engages in illegal acts, drug dealing or anything else, in this case, it would be violation of Revised Code 5321, which under the Ohio tenant law obligates a tenant to conduct him or herself in a manner so as not to disturb a neighbor's peaceful enjoyment of the premises. AMHA, in this case, could easily seize onto that section of the Revised Code and operate under the normal proceedings of terminating or canceling a lease, and then the normal legal means of evicting a tenant. We've seen this case, and I do want to correct a discrepancy of the appellants. Ms. Morris said that there has been no cases that have recognized a hostile housing environment claim in terms of based on the harassment of another tenant. Again, I don't believe it's based on the harassment of another tenant. It's based on the landlord's own negligence in failing to act. But in the Bradley case out of the Eastern District of Virginia, that court recognized a claim based on the harassment of another tenant under Virginia's Fair Housing Act. In the Martinez case in the Central District of California, that court recognized a cause of action under their Fair Housing Act in California. And the Eighth Circuit in the Neudecker case in 2003 recognized a cause of action for harassment which was initiated by a fellow resident under the Federal Fair Housing Act. So I don't believe...
Isn't that the crucial issue here? There was active negligence, or there was active discrimination on the part of the person who is being held liable. Here we're talking about one-step removal. We're talking about individuals who are harassing other tenants, And that goes into my question about the lease, because what was the obligation that the housing authority had if something was brought to its attention? If it didn't do it, well, you might have a breach of duty there, but.
Well, as the employment context, all three of those cases recognize an obligation on behalf of a landlord to the other tenants when a tenant is engaged in harassing behavior. To the extent that you may find that the lease in this issue for AMHA doesn't impose a duty on AMHA to correct the situation, the Ohio Fair Housing Act certainly does. It requires the landlord to act appropriately and immediately to correct the hostile housing environment. Discrimination under 41-1208 must be interpreted broadly.
How broad is the hostile housing environment going to be? I mean, here, obviously, the action of the neighbors was reprehensible. But would it include, say, in an apartment building that furnishes washers and dryers and has a laundry room, somebody who fills up all the washers and dryers and leaves for work and does that on a regular basis so nobody else can use it, or has everybody has a patio and they have a collection of obnoxious things on their patio, or you know, you can imagine all of the things that tick neighbors off.
Absolutely.
So, some we would perhaps laugh at, and some are more serious. But if you say a hostile environment, doesn't that encompass
absolutely
almost anything that you can imagine in the eyes of the beholder, in the eyes of the neighbor?
Your Honor, I understand your concerns, and which is why we're asking the court to look directly to its sample decision and adopt the entire five-part test. The test requires, first, that the victim is a member of a protected class, that harassment, specifically harassment, is unwelcome, that the harassment is based on the membership in the protected class, so you wouldn't get into the situation where a person has too many plants or they just play loud music or something like that. The fourth prong is a hugely important prong, and it requires that the harassment be sufficiently severe or pervasive to affect the terms, conditions, or privileges of the tenancy.
Well, that's where the facts of this case fall out, because we're talking about a skateboard incident, but there was no allegation of any racial slur or any epithet. The police report didn't contain anything like that. All of this came up at a later point.
Your Honor, this case arrived
at a point that strikes in favor of the housing authority, that this was a dispute between two people who couldn't get along, two families that really just didn't like each other for whatever reason. And suddenly, after one of the parties vacated, then it became a different kind of an incident. I think that's their argument.
You know, Your Honor, I understand that argument on the facts. The procedure of this case came up on summary judgment, and the parties agreed to certain facts, and the factual record wasn't fully developed. And so we don't have all of the facts.
But the police report was developed.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Nothing in there about any of these allegations.
Well, and I think the proper approach in this case would be to send it back to develop the facts in this case. But I don't think the facts of this case have anything to do with whether Ohio is going to recognize a hostile housing environment claim.
But your allegation is the fourth prong has to be pervasive and, I forget what the words that you used, but the trial court found on the factual basis, based on the evidence the parties agreed to present to her, that even if you find a hostile environment cause of action, this just didn't reach to it. There wasn't the evidence there.
Well, Your Honor, I would direct you to the trial court's opinion, because they used the wrong standard. They didn't use a severe or pervasive standard. They actually asked whether the conduct was so extreme that it was threatening or offensive, or physically threatening or extreme. And that's not the standard that we're asking for. We're asking for the standard set out in Hampel. And just so I can illuminate the final prong is two-part. It says that the harassment is either initiated specifically by the landlord or a supervisor, or in the second step, that the landlord knew or should have known about the harassment and failed to take appropriate and immediate steps to correct that.
Counsel, Hampel was premised in great part on 41-1202A, which particularly talked about an employer. and the what an employer is prohibited from doing. What portion, and I know you cited 08, which is the broad category about discrimination law, should be interpreted broadly, but what section of the statute are you referring to with respect to hostile environment?
Your Honor, I would point you specifically to 4112.02H4, which says that no persons should discriminate in the terms, conditions of renting, leasing, or subleasing, or in the furnishings of facilities, services, or privileges in connection with the occupancy or use of any housing accommodation.
Doesn't that sound as though it's active discrimination that we're talking about there?
The discrimination in that particular section is not limited to a harassing sense, and it wouldn't make sense that we would only limit that particular provision to co-tenants. If we're talking about the furnishing of facilities, services, or privileges in connection with a tenancy, it's hard to imagine how that could even apply to a co-tenant rather than a landlord. Your Honor, I do want to give my co-counsel some time to argue.
You'd like to have some time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Krumman. Mr. Margolius.
I'd like to go back to the Judge Stormer right over here.
Oh, the over here. Sorry.
Analysis. Judge Stormer does use the terms severe and pervasive, so she does use the same standard that you are alleging. And she finds on a factual basis that even if you were to recognize this cause of action, it is not severe and pervasive. That's a factual conclusion, and the Court of Appeals on a 2-to-1 basis reversed her.
That's correct.
Now, how do they have the ability to do that when it's a weight of the evidence decision? It has to be unanimous to reverse.
The Court of Appeals looked to the way Judge Stormer drew her conclusions, and they felt that the Rule 56 standard of not interpreting facts in the light most favorable to the non-movement, and that would have been my
still
client.
Still at weight of the evidence, and they can't reverse on weight of the evidence unless they're unanimous. So don't we have a failure there?
Your Honors, I don't think that's really the case. I think the improper standard was used, and the trial court didn't really even understand the severe or pervasive standard. They were also looking at it as in there had to be some sort of level of violence, and that's not what's required for harassment.
She doesn't mention violence in her opinion. It's not in there.
I believe there is issues as to whether violent misconduct was raised, and that was what was raised at the trial court level by the defendants in this matter. So if they didn't look at the facts properly, and the facts here were that there was a continuous stream of racial epithets, and I don't want to use the improper language, but about as bad an epithet as you can direct that an African-American was used on a continuous basis, not only at Ms. Harper, but her family, her children, and her guests, and that this was severe or pervasive, that means it's an issue of fact to determine whether or not there was, in fact, a hostile environment created at this particular housing development. We also have a landlord who felt that discrimination simply doesn't exist, and that screwed up pretty much all the facts in this matter because there's no real evidence of the complaints of Ms. Harper. She did, in fact, complain, but this landlord felt that discrimination no longer existed because she simply saw a number of white and black couples together, saw interracial children, and she came to the sort of Pollyanna-ish conclusion that racial discrimination no longer exists. So if we have the situation where there's a continuous stream of racial epithets and it's interfering to a severe or pervasive type of level, well, then harassment is a recognized form of discrimination. Because we have to remember that harassment and discrimination are really one form of the other. In fact, discrimination just doesn't end at the doorstep. It can continue into the relationship of the particular landlord and tenant.
Well, and counsel, wasn't there a reference to the police over this?
Yes, there was.
And the police investigated it?
Somewhat.
Well,
they conducted.
The landlord's not responsible for how the police investigate this. And the police came back and said, this is a dispute between neighbors. This is, you know, there's no, so presumably there's no danger, there's no, it's not volatile and ready to, or there hasn't anybody, hasn't been past physical altercations.
Right. Well, the police did investigate it, but there's a disconnect between what the landlord was supposed to find out from the police investigation and what actually occurred. The landlord here didn't find out the results of the police investigation besides a he said, she said type of scenario, and the police were really only looking to prevent issues of violence. And those issues of violence fall far short of the racial epithets that were used here. In fact, the police knew that the term, I've got to use it, the term nigger was used from a white family against blacks, but they felt it was not threatening. Well, it might not have been threatening to the point of violence, but it's certainly quite relevant to a hostile environment
for
this family.
And I understand fully that, but AMHA then, according to the trial court's opinion, chose to monitor the situation and then move the cases away from the environment.
That did occur that the Kasichs did move away, but that was unrelated to the harassment allegations.
It ended it, though, didn't it? Didn't that
it ended
deal
it.
With the immediate problem short of an eviction?
It ended it, but some 8 or so months later. And so what happened was the Kasichs, who actually asked for a hardship transfer because they were complaining of racial animosity, they were given the ability to move, but the Harpers had to endure 8 or so months of racial discrimination, this constant form of harassment directed at their children, directed at them every time they left.
But what we're getting at is the appropriate response of AMHA to stand in the shoes of an employer, and that's what you're analogizing here, that the employer has to do something to diffuse a hostile work environment if the employer is not the cause of the hostile work environment, if it's an employee-on-employee dispute. Okay, and we have the same thing here, tenant versus tenant, and your allegation here is that the AMHA needs to have done something to diffuse this situation so it could reestablish a pleasant living situation for these parties.
That's right.
Okay, and so for 6 or 8 months, until the one family moved, there's steps taken, you know, referral to the police, the monitoring, trying to ferret out what's happening here.
But, Your Honor, there really wasn't the monitoring. And if there was the type of monitoring that you're referencing, that would have done the job. In fact, the landlord could have established a policy. We could have created some of those affirmative defenses that are available in employment in housing if the landlord had created an anti-harassment policy and then promptly and effectively remediated the situation. This wouldn't have become a lawsuit, but they didn't promptly and effectively remediate this situation. And that's what the goal is. It's not to create another issue of liability, it's to prevent future harassment. That's why it's a knowledge and an action standard. And the landlord here just simply did not follow up, did not manage what was going on between these tenants, and it allowed the situation to fester, and in fact allowed it to escalate to threats of violence. So if the landlord had followed up with the police, if they had actually asked the police what each of these particular sets of neighbors had said and found out, and well, gosh, they should have at least told the police, which they did not, that there were a bunch of related issues rather than giving them a couple isolated circumstances where situations were getting out of hand, well, then this would be a different situation. But of course, the police have more important things to do, and that's really to prevent violence. And that's not the sole issue here. The issue really is whether there's interference at a level that's severe or pervasive for the African Americans who are living there.
And I think that's important, but what you've got to look at is what did the landlord do in response to that? And you cannot, you know, disregard the fact that there was a referral to the police department, that, you know, it might not have been as quick as your clients would have thought appropriate, but there was not a lack of response. Would you agree? There was not a lack of response, whether you agree it was the appropriate response.
I agree to the extent that there wasn't a complete lack of response. It was a very belated response, and it was a half-hearted response. It only occurred at the very end of the harassment. So my clients had to endure months of harassment before the landlord actually turned it over to the police. And then the police, really, they arrived on the scene in sort of an ignorant type of state because they didn't know all the previous history. And I think it's the landlord's overriding duty. This is a business, of course. They have a minimal duty. We're not trying to create a big duty here, but a minimal duty to just make sure that these African Americans are allowed to reside in their apartment free of this racial interference. And the Kasichs were blatant in trying to create that for months and months, and then finally the landlord did something. So, yes, finally the landlord did do something, but it was too late.
You've used your time, Mr. Margolius.
All right, thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Morris, you've saved a minute and a half of your time.
The emphasis that I want to place is that the issue before the court is not limited to the facts of this case in the sense that Ohio has not applied a hostile living environment standard under the authority of its 411202H, and we're asking the court not to do that. If the court does apply that, it essentially is creating a new tort that creates an unworkable standard for landlords, and I think an unintended consequence for tenants as well. In this regard, the Fair Housing Act is in no way limited to public housing authorities. It's in no way limited to landlords who have rental properties. It applies to everyone who owns property in Ohio. And it's just a matter of then playing out the consequences as that new tort is applied throughout the state with respect to property.
But right now, if there's two independent property owners and one is making trespassing to the extent where it's interfering with the right in use and enjoyment of the other's property, and there's no third party landlord as we have in here, there's a cause of action that can be brought by one property owner to the other.
Under the Fair Housing Act. There is to tenant on tenant as well.
Okay, so
I say there's
we're not
no
creating
difference.
Anything new. What the creation here is to extend it under these circumstances to a landlord.
I disagree. I think that you are creating a duty on a landlord where none exists and there's no statutory support for it. It is not analogous to employment law. Essentially, Judge Slaby got it right in the dissent. Landlords simply do not have the extent of control. The relationship that a landlord has with a tenant is very different than the relationship that an employer has to an employee. And it is a very logical extension of an existing duty in the domain of employment law. It is actually creating a new duty in the domain of living. And property. And thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Morris. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.